Hey, it's Joe. If you're like me, you are trying very hard to be a healthy, resilient, highly functional human being and athlete. We eat a healthy diet and live a vigorous life, and then we try to recover as fast as possible to get back to the fun stuff. But it turns out that's not enough. We are still slowly losing ground. Well, it turns out that all that crazy stuff we've been hearing about, maybe even trying over the years, can actually help us to function more like we did when we were younger. Today, I am rejoined by Dr. Mike T. Nelson, who joins me to provide a framework for training our bodies to tolerate a wider range of environmental conditions, and how that expanded range, or physiological flexibility, can actually turn back the clock, help us to recover some of the functionality we've lost to aging, maybe keep us from losing even more ground. Okay, maybe you're already doing sauna and cold therapy, or Wim Hof breathing and breath holds, but listen in and understand why these and other interventions work, and how to organize them intelligently to enhance your resilience and physical potential. Whether you're an athlete or someone striving to feel younger and stronger, this episode is packed with great insights to help you thrive. All right, let's talk to Dr. Mike T. Nelson about his physiologic flexibility and adaptive homeostasis. Dr. Mike, welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me back. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, man, it's been 2.5 years.
Yeah, it's been a little while.
Yeah, I've been really looking forward to this one. We had to schedule this one way out, but I had to talk to you. And I'm going to give you here a chance in just a second to remind our audience about your background, how you became such a progressive, I think, ahead of your time thinker in developing protocols for athletes of all ages on how to get stronger and faster and more athletic and also healthier. But let me kick it off by saying that I want to take a different angle on this physiologic flexibility thing, which I just love that you have come up with. On the Wise Athlete Podcast, we are older athletes. I'm an older athlete. So there's a few things to know about that. I'll just point them out. They're obvious. One is that we are not couch potatoes. We are not the people asking you, what's the least exercise I need to do, right? You know, we're out there doing too much probably. We're not recovering enough because we love it. But that's good. But still, we aren't who we were. I didn't used to say that, but it is true for me too. And that's despite some really significant efforts to be as healthy and as fit as I can. I'm slowly over time, I'm losing the fight against time. But still, I want to slow that down. If I can claw some of it back, I want some of that too. And I think your approach is the right one for us. I tell you, I have adopted it as sort of like my central theme in my efforts. Of course, there's lots of little pieces to it, but that's the central theme. So more and more, I'm focusing on living a vigorous life to train my body, to tell my body, be more like you were when we were younger, you know, more robust and durable. I could recover faster and adapt better to stresses like exercise or hot or cold temperatures or even eating shitty food that tastes great without feeling like shit afterwards.
Totally.
So, all right, Dr. Mike, remind us who you are and what do you think you can contribute to our efforts to be younger?
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate it. So my undergrad, I did a Bachelor of Arts, Natural Science. I did a Master's in Mechanical Engineering, Biomechanics. And then my PhD was in exercise physiology in metabolism, primarily looking at metabolic flexibility and heart rate variability. And so I have my own company, which is Extreme Human Performance. So we do consulting with different levels of athletes. We do one-on-one programming, nutrition. I kind of do, for most of the people I work with, I kind of do everything from their warm-ups to their cool-downs to programming, exercise, whatever they have going on. Normally, they've got something weird, like it's a mechanical issue or it's a metabolic issue. They can't really just follow a program and be like, oh, I'm good now. There's some sort of weird X factor that moves around that's going on. Some of them are older. Some of them have, diseases, that type of thing too. And then I work, as I said, as associate professor for the Carrig Institute. I work part-time for rapid health optimization. I do some consulting for Tecton so that I have a ketone beverage.
Sweet.
And yeah, a few other random projects. And then I also, not totally relevant for your audience, but I just finished the Triphasic 2 book with Coach Cal Dietz, which just came out a couple days ago. So, yeah, it's been pretty fun.
Awesome. All right. Well, again, welcome back. I'll say that I was, back when it occurred to me to reach back out to you to get you back on the show, I was reading a paper. It was talking about declining adaptive homeostasis as a marker of aging.
Yeah, Kelvin Davies.
Yeah. Of course, I'm familiar with the hallmarks of aging papers, the 9 and now the 12. And they don't mention this one.
No.
But you know what? They're right in that, I mean, at least as far as my body is concerned, that I have lost more and more over time the ability to adapt to things without training.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't lost my ability to adapt altogether. Just recently, I've started using a sauna.
Nice.
Well, man, I could barely stay in there for 10 minutes, you know, at first. But, you know, now I'm in there 30 minutes. I mean, on minute 31, I'm bolting for that door.
Yeah, yeah. 'Cause
eventually, it's like, I got to get out of here. I'm going to die.
Totally.
But still, well, that's how I felt after 10 minutes when I first started. So I'm not dead yet. You know, I can adapt. I just need to give my body the signals that it needs. And what I need to know is, well, what are those signals? What are the things that are going to give me the, you know, biggest bang for the buck? I did your certification for the Metflex.
Yeah, you did.
And that was just amazing. That really kind of got my head on straight for how to think about this stuff. So thanks for that. But one of the things that you educated me on was you had this leverage, I think you called it, where it was this 2x2, where it was like you could plot out the different things you could do.
Coaching leverage, the physiologic response times the client's ability or the psychological component to change.
Exactly. So you could pick out the things that would have a big impact versus a small impact, and the things that I could actually do because I liked them or I was willing to do them versus the things of being like, I'm never doing that. And you'd find the first things you'd give me would be the things that would have a big impact and I would do them.
Yeah, shocker.
I mean, my God, what a great idea.
Oh, such a brilliant coach.
So what I wanted, you know, what I think you have done in your metabolic flexibility and your physiologic flexibility, you haven't tried to pick on the 1 million ways the body functions and listed them all out. You picked out the ones that seem to be accessible to the most people that would have the biggest effect. I think you mostly talk about it in terms of, you know, how a person can be healthier and that can make them a better athlete. I think it's still the same thing, though, with an older person wanting to be healthier to be a better athlete. Maybe it's also making them younger-like, you know, a younger phenotype of themselves. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things I do for myself and for clients related to aging is if you had the same output and you could move the same with the same capacity as you were younger, would you really feel any older? My argument is probably not. I mean, like, yeah, there's some pain, there's a couple other things, but my argument is that almost all of the things we talk about with aging are primarily output related.
Functional, right?
Like, yes, you know, you can have joint pain and stuff like that, but most of what you're looking at is, oh, I wasn't able to do this movement before. I couldn't lift this weight. I couldn't do this repeated task as much. I couldn't run 5 miles or, you know, most of the things that people want to do, in my opinion, are output based, which is good because we can train to get better at them. Again, if you were elite level at some level in your, you know, 25 years old, yeah, you probably may not get back to that level again, but you can, you know, kind of fight that sort of decay of that. And so that's what I think now is starting to be more appreciated with longevity and aging. You know, we're looking at like the top three things. We have very good data. Number one is probably cardiovascular output, so VO2 max. Number two is lower body strength and muscle size. It's really a proxy for strength. And then three is actually grip strength. You know, we've got very good data showing that all three of those in terms of longevity, those are probably like the three things you would want to work on. Yeah, and there's other things that still factor into all of that. But in terms of the data we currently have, those would be like your top three. So if you back up from that then, so when I did like the flex diet certification on metabolic flexibility, my thought was, okay, what are kind of like the big rocks, a little bit more on the nutrition side. Yeah, we do talk about exercise and some movement stuff and some sleep. And you have protein, fats, carbohydrates, micronutrition, neat, So non-exercise activity thermogenesis, just simply walking, twitching, just low level movement, exercise, and then sleep. And then, like you said, I organize them based off of the coaching leverage, because from just a pure, so initially I actually had to set up on just the physiologic response, and that's what I was going to do. But my goal was to teach it to people who are interested in it, but also to teach it to coaches. And so I walked myself literally, it sounds kind of weird, but like pretend me coaching myself through the method.
Sure.
And then I would lock myself actually in a float chamber. And then I would try to poke holes into the little models I had created. So I'd spend 90 minutes lying there just trying to poke holes in the little model I created. Huh. And I realized that if I only did physiologic response, I may start with something like sleep. And then I'm like, okay, cool. So if I start with sleep, I can show you all these tons of literature to show sleep super important. How has my experience been coaching sleep with most people? Dude, horrible. I'd rather put my head through a wall, right? Because this is back 5 years ago when like no one was talking about sleep. You know, it would all invariably come down to, we can increase your quality of sleep so high, and yes, that's important. But after that, Bob, if you're sleeping 4.5 hours a night and you're not a Dec 2 mutant, like you're going to need more sleep. And that goes into a value judgment. You're not going to put up your kids for adoption. You're not going to quit doing what you're doing. You're not going to drive an hour to your job. So like, oh, so you're telling me that, you know, 2 hours I spend watching Netflix at night, I just need to go to bed. Kind of. Like, I don't know where else we're going to get more time from in your schedule. Like, oh, it's the stupidest thing. I'm never doing it. So I realized sleep was important, but the client's ability to change was just very, very hard compared to protein. Like you tell most people, like, okay, you want to lose weight, you want to increase your recovery, and you want to get better body composition and probably get healthier, and I want you to eat more of something. They think you're insane. You're like, no, I was told I was supposed to eat less of everything. But what if I told you you need to eat more of something, but it's something very specific? And they're like, oh, what is this? I'm interested. It's like, well, just eat more protein. Oh, so I get to eat more food? Yes, you get to eat more food, right? So that was pretty easy sell. They're like, okay, you know, granted, it does take some more work and that type of thing. But so protein ended up being number one because a high physiologic response, high client ability to change. Sleep ended up coming out dead last. You know, still very, very high physiologic response, but the implementation and clients, you know, preconceived notions and their ability just to change their sleep habits was really, really hard. And I realized that's a much longer term, almost kind of value play where it's like, okay, now you start feeling better. Now you're more invested in your schedule. Now maybe you'll ask about, oh, so some other things I can do to improve my sleep. It takes more education. You know, you can look at like the Prohaska model of change and all this stuff, but it's a very long-term thing, you know? So that's how I came up with the ranking to know exactly your question. Well, if I'm new, or even if I'm a new coach, like there's all these things, you know, do I, you know, shove red light up my ass, or do I do all these other things to try to increase my, you know, mitochondrial health, and, you know, my mitophagy is going down the tubes, and it's like, okay, so people just needed a framework within the system of where to start.
Right, right. You know, and even some, I'm not sure what your thoughts are on this, but my personal approach, which has, you know, stolen what you taught me. Also, I put constraints on myself because otherwise I'll end up with, you know, 100 supplements that I'm taking. Yeah. You know, because everything's good for me a little bit. Marginal gains, right? Even if it's like 0.1%, if I take 1,000 of them, I'm 100% better.
Yeah. Well, the amount of people I redo their whole supplement list and like take away most things and add a couple things is... it's kind of crazy now, but yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Okay. This idea of progressive overload, everybody's heard of it. They maybe don't really fully get it, but you know, the idea is sensible. It's logical even that, you know, the idea that you put a little stress that's a little more than your body's ready for, and it says, oh, well, I better deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea of progressive overload, it seems to me like it doesn't just apply to growing muscles. It's this whole thing that you talk about, the, you know, getting used to hot temperatures and cold temperatures. What it already knows how to do, you're telling it, hey, be really good at this. And that is what a youthful person has the ability to do without much effort, and an older person has to try harder. Well, how should we do this?
Yeah. And so after I did the flux that I had stirred, and yeah, I'd spent a lot of time looking at metabolic flexibility. Like I said, it was part of my PhD research and published on it, all that kind of stuff. Started using with clients going back, God, probably 14, 15 years ago now, which is kind of wild. And a few years after that, probably 5 years after that, I was like, okay, that's cool for metabolism. There's definitely some things to work out here. But what happens if we take that idea and we scale it up to you as a human organism? And so in the context of the flux diet cert, those are kind of like level one, like your big rocks. Like, yes, get those things down to, you want to be, I often joke, like a B student at least in them. If you're failing all of them, like for God's sakes, don't worry about the other stuff right now. But if you're a B student, like you're above average, like you got some more stuff together, that's good. So I started thinking, okay, what would be the next level? If those principles are true, how do we extrapolate those? And so I think my biased belief is that your body is very much survival based and that we almost never lose our ability to adapt. Like I did some work in the cardiovascular med tech space for about 10 years, and we would see people with this huge, massively dilated, just massively huge hearts due to, you know, different cardiac diseases. And the company I worked for, they would put implantable electrical devices in them to retime the heart to actually beat more normal again. And all the cardiologists, electrophysiologists were all just amazed that some of these hearts literally almost went back to a normal size.
Wow.
And all we did was just give it the correct stimulus. This wasn't exercise, but this was getting better perfusion. This was all this stuff. And so that really hit me of like, oh, like some of these people were sleeping with two pillows under themselves at night. Their chest is half full of fluid. Like they were bad off. And one of the guys, again, it's an outlier, but, you know, 6 months after this, rode his bike across the state of friggin' Nebraska.
Wow.
Right? Now, he was an athlete before. So it kind of reinforced to me that we never lose the ability to adapt entirely. The adaptation process is probably a little bit different, but our capacities of where we start are definitely different. So then the question is, okay, well, what things should we spend our time trying to adapt to? Because there's a whole, like you said, there's a whole laundry list of different things. So then I went and thought, okay, if the body is survival-based, then we've got, you know, basic nutrition, exercise, and sleep. What are the next targets? So again, my bias is these homeostatic regulators, things that you know the body has to hold constant or all hell breaks loose. So temperature, right? Humans are what they call homeotherms. 98.6, it's actually 97.7 if you're a weirdo like me and actually don't believe anything you read and look up the literature on it. And it will vary per individual, but it's a set point. And we can do things like put ourselves in cold water. We can put ourselves in cold temperature. We can go into saunas. And there's plenty of literature, especially on the heat side, showing a period of, you know, thermal adaptation or acclimatization. We can put ourselves in high areas of oxygen, like hyperbaric, or low, like we can go to a higher altitude. We can change pH. We can change and expand the fuels into lactate and ketones. So I came up with targeting these homeostatic regulators, so temperature, pH, fuels, and then breathing, which is just CO2 and O2 regulation. There's more beyond that, but I thought those are the main big ones that the body is always going to hold constant. They overlap with each other, and they're also very practical. And we've got a ton of literature showing adaptations in it. If you know, we put you on the rower and had you do some horrible, you know, repeated wind gates for 30 seconds all out, like we do that for a period of time, your body's going to get better at handling hydrogen ions and lactate. So the framework I came up with is the physiologic flexibility. And then I do think that it's worth spending some time to increase adaptations in those areas. And then just to sort of run the thought experiment, if we think about cases where you cannot do that, a lot of times those are associated with aging. So the story I've often told is, you know, my grandma, you know, fortunately lived to be, you know, over 100 years old. But when we would visit her at the end, when she was in the nursing home, it would be about 76 degrees in there. And she would have like a sweatshirt on and an afghan. And she was just like freezing. Like her ability to regulate temperature, and this is like across the board in, you know, most nursing homes, was really, really bad. Now, some of that might just be purely due to age, but I would argue most of it because especially in later in her life, she just wasn't able to get outside nearly as much. So she doesn't have any exposure to any differences in temperature. So I think it is primarily more, we've withdrawn the stimulus to give our body a reason to adapt, then it's that these things degrade over time with aging. I think they do probably degrade somewhat with aging. I don't think anyone's going to deny that. But it feels like the more we look at new and newer literature, there's a case study of a guy who set the world record for indoor rowing, so ergometer, at 92 years of age. Wow. Just crazy. I can't remember his numbers, but they're very impressive. The insane part is that he did not start doing any formal exercise and did not do any rowing until he was age 70.
Jeez.
You know, so most people would think, oh, he was just an elite athlete when he was a kid and he's just kind of kept it up. No, he didn't do dick until he was 70. You know, so to me, like, you know, it's a case report. But, you know, things like that are like hinting that it's probably more the stimulus that we've just not given our body in a nice controlled fashion to adapt to.
Yeah.
Again, you go back to progressive overload. You're going to look at, you know, like with weights, you're going to lift more weight, do more work, more volume, or better density. You could move load, you know, faster quality of movement too. But that's the same thing if you're playing with sauna. Like, what are you going to play with? The temperature, if you can control it, the dose you're in there, and if you start doing intervals, like how much time do you have outside of the sauna?
All right, this is great. I mean, look, what doesn't fall into the use it or lose it bucket?
Exactly.
That can't be a shock to anybody. The good news is that if you have lost it, you can get it back.
100%, yeah.
Maybe you can't get it back 100%, but you can get better.
Oh, definitely.
And that's good enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do some details here.
Yeah, for sure.
What are these things that we can do? And of course, we're not looking to get certified here in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But some examples of what to do, and then some idea of like, well, how can you tell if it's working, right? I mean, I can tell if I can stay in the sauna longer. Okay, so that's got to be good. You know, but is there any other thing that I might be able to measure so I can just track, is it having some positive effect on me?
Yeah. So I like people to have some sort of just global tracking in their life. And it doesn't have to be anything complicated. I'm a big fan of people doing some type of recreation. You know, you can use your sport of recreation as something to make it better. Some people like doing triathlon. Some people like running. I like doing a lot of kiteboarding. Hell, even tennis, pickleball, pick one. I don't care what it is. But something that's, you know, kind of considered a recreational sport or activity. You can tell over time, like, if you've gotten better in the skill or did you get better in just kind of the raw horsepower. Like, if you take downhill skiing, hey, you know, I was able to ski like a full day now and I wasn't able to in the past. So I can only get like half a day, or I did, you know, this many number of black runs, or the conditions are horrible and I didn't crash. And so I like people having like kind of an external compass for that. And for some people, it could be, hey, I got to, you know, bend down on the floor and play with my grandkids today. My knee didn't like feel like it was going to freaking kill me. It could be very simple stuff, but it should be something that you're looking at externally that has a high value in your life that's important to you. And whatever that is, that's for each person to decide. So that would be kind of the ultimate evaluation. Now, the caveat to that is when you start doing stuff, you may not necessarily see a transfer right away just because of adaptation, right? It's going to take you a while to build up these skills. You know, if you're training in the gym, you want your right bicep to be bigger. It's not going to be instantly bigger after one session, right? It's going to be several sessions, etc. So you do have to allow a fair amount of time for the adaptation process. Usually, if I would do like a needs analysis on someone, if we're just looking at the physiologic flexibility, all you simply do is just kind of go through and just ask them about their life, and you just put little check boxes. Like if you're someone who says, you know, hey, I live in a warm environment and I just run from one air-conditioned space to the next. I never exercise outside. I only exercise in commercial air-conditioned gyms. I didn't even like walking the dog. I can guarantee you, like, temperature regulation is probably going to be something you need to work on. And how you would do that could be, you may not even need a sauna. You may not even need a cold water immersion. Maybe exercise outside. Which I can hear everyone who lives in Arizona be like, no, it's like 100 degrees. I'm like, maybe you could go early. Maybe you could go in the evening.
Yeah.
Right. Or you can get a sauna. Saunas are great. Get a cold plunge. Great. Awesome. Most of the time you can find a low or no tech way of doing it. Most of the time tap water is cold enough. You can get some response from it. Just take a cold shower. Just run tap water in your bathtub, throw a bag of ice in. It's probably going to be cold enough for what you need for most people. Mm-hmm. So you don't necessarily need to get fancy. If you tell me like, hey, I'd never do any interval, any high output stuff that's very, very short duration. You know, 30, 60, 90 seconds. or maybe even up to a couple minutes, depending on what you're looking at. I can guarantee like pH regulation is probably going to be something you definitely need to work at.
You mean like maximum effort?
Yeah. So you should, and there's different ways of doing this. So like the really simple one I do with clients all the time is if they have access to like a Concept 2 rower, I'll have them do one 500 meter row once a week. And that's really not that much. Like depending on where you're at, that's a minute and a half to maybe 2 minutes, maybe 3 minutes if you're, you know, really on the low end of the spectrum. You're talking a couple minutes. But that's going to be a pretty hard effort. Like you're going to definitely warm up before, take complete rest. And when you go, like it's going to be pretty all out for that full 500 meters. Because I want them to see, to hit kind of those high heart rates. I want them to kind of get some, you know, lactate and hydrogen ions. Now, again, you can build on that. Like you can definitely go beyond that for sure. But I think just doing that once a week, which is something almost everyone can progressively work into, has like a huge benefit. And you also get up into those higher elevated heart rates. You can do it in a safe manner. It's non-impactful. You could do this on a bike too. It takes a little bit more effort on a bike, depending on how good a cyclist you are, etc. So I think that's something that most people could do in just a couple, like a few minutes per week that probably has a very high dividend to pay out.
I guess I would add on to that, that if at the end of that session you said, man, that felt great, then you did not do it right.
Yeah, you probably need to go a little harder. That is, so like when I have people, like especially when I used to train people here more in person, we would actually, we kind of stamp their RPE, meaning most, and I found this out from working in the lab. Like, so I did a bunch of exercise phys studies. And for the one study we had, there's a couple people I honestly couldn't use their data. Because it was like you had to go as hard as you could to what's called volitional fatigue. And we have monitors on you. Like we could tell you if you actually hit, you know, the threshold or not. But the one thing we couldn't monitor was the self-rated perceived effort or RPE. And so once they hit a 9 or above, and we might have used a Borg scale from 6 to 20, but whatever, then they were done with the study. So they had to go like pretty much all out. And then once they raise their hand and say, okay, I'm all out, then the test would stop. Unfortunately, some people kind of figured this out and had never done a lot of, you know, very hard exercise. So it'd be like, you're watching, I'm like, okay, what's your RPE? It's a 2. I'm thinking that's way more than a 2. And of course, we would clearly try to explain this to them ahead of time and everything like that. And then we'd have them do, you know, a VO2 max. So they had an idea of what was going on before the trial. And you would see like, oh, okay, it's a 4, you know, and then a couple minutes later, like, I don't know. Maybe a 5, and 2 minutes later, like, it's a 10, I'm done. You know, you're like, okay, like it just, it's a foreign thing if you're not used to it. So the thing that I always used to get people to do would be an all-out car push. Because if you've ever pushed a car before, one, it's mechanically, it feels pretty good. Like you will automatically kind of put your joints and stuff in the right place to get the most leverage. And it's pretty joint friendly. It's concentric only, no eccentric, no impact. But you also know that once you start that thing in motion, that momentum, that mass, if it slows down, is going to be horrible to go again. So it has this sort of weird built-in, like intrinsic property of it, unless you're like just really wussing out, like it's hard not to go pretty all out on a car push, especially when I give you a set distance you have to cross. So that would be kind of, we do a long car push, and that would be kind of like their, you know, RPE of a 9 or a 10. Obviously, you can use a rower, you can use all sorts of other stuff. But for people who had never really done anything, you know, difficult or very vigorous on exercise, that's what I would use. And then we would mark that. Ideally, we'd give them a heart rate. And then we'd say, okay, that would look like that was probably a 9 or maybe even a 10. And we would say, your max heart rate over this time, usually you need a couple minutes to hit it, was a 161. And I would put a note in their file, 161. Now, if they ever pass that heart rate, that is now their new max. So they came out and did some crazy workout and they hit 165. Cool. For all working purposes, now your new max heart rate is 165. Mm-hmm. So whatever you would hit, that would be kind of your max, both on a heart rate and just sort of a rating of perceived exertion. So,
well, good. And I guess the practical reality is that that's not really their max heart rate. But if that's the highest they can ever get to, then that's...
For all practical purposes, it is. Yeah.
All right, good. So this is useful. Let's go through them a piece at a time here.
Sure.
So we'll talk about what are the 4, you know, regulators that you're working on, and then what's the up and the down, you know, the either side of it, because you're trying to push the range. You're trying to make the range bigger. And so they have to experience something that's a little more than they're used to. And then over time, they can go bigger and bigger. Tell us about the, you know, the 4x2 and how to do them. And maybe mention a progression, like start here, then go to there. And then the metrics, if you got some.
Yeah. So the first one would be temperature. And again, you're right. Like in the grand picture, we want to increase both your exposure to hot and cold, or the range on each one is something they call the HDR, human dynamic range. So if your range is real small, we want to see that get bigger over time. Now, if you wanted, in my biased opinion, do the maximal adaptation in the shortest period of time, then I like for almost all of these frequency, but not as intense. So for example, if you said, hey, I pick cold water, I've got access to a cold water immersion just to make my life easy. I can send it to whatever temperature I want. I'll do whatever the hell you tell me to do. I would say, great, we're going to work on temperature. We're going to work primarily on cold water immersion. We might do a little bit of heat, but only like once or twice a week. So we want to move our adaptive resources more towards cold, just like the barbell example. And then once we've run that for 4, 5, 6 weeks, then we might add a little bit more heat and we're going to put cold kind of on maintenance. It's like if you said, hey, I really, really want to improve my VO2 max, we're probably going to move a lot of your resources to VO2 max work. You're still going to lift, but it's going to be more minimal. We're going to try to put that a little bit on maintenance. So you've only got so much time. You've only got so many resources. So I do think you will see a little bit faster adaptations with that. Again, you can do both at the same time. It's not necessarily bad. Then I would have them do it in the time of day. Doesn't matter much. I do like cold water immersion primarily earlier in the day. You do get like, you know, some endorphins, you know, they go up and that type of thing, which can mess with your sleep. Most people temperature wise start at 50, 55 degrees. And then you're going to get in and, you know, ideally, you know, up to your chin if you can, and then control your breathing as fast as possible. Again, you're trying to take a stressor and you're trying to normalize that stressor internally as fast as possible, which at first is going to take some practice, just like all things. And then time is probably going to be short, like 30 to 60 seconds might be more than enough. But over time, you're going to go a little bit longer. And once you can hit it around 5 minutes, relatively easy, nice, calm breathing, no shivering, then I would say drop the temperature to maybe 49, 48, and then go all the way back down to 30 seconds and then repeat again. Now, within this, you can also play with what I call sort of the wave method. When you get in, if you've done this enough, you will definitely feel like this is cold. This is stupid. Why am I doing this? This is dumb. I'm an idiot. Okay. Oh, I need to get control of my breath. Okay. Get control of my breathing. Okay. And then after about 30 to 60 seconds, like your skin kind of goes a little bit numb, like it doesn't feel as bad. But then you'll kind of hit that second wave where it starts coming up, where it starts feeling more and more and more difficult. And I'll usually have people kind of, if that wave doesn't kind of what I call normalize and go back down, then I would just get out at that point. Right. Because different things like sleep, stress level, fasting, all these other things will change your ability to handle cold water. So both those methods work. Run that for, you know, 6-8 weeks, and then maybe only do it once or twice, and then do the exact same thing with heat. So if you have a sauna and you have control of the temperature, start at an easy temperature. You can hang out for 5 to 10 minutes, you know, make it pretty easy. And then over time, you're going to play with the duration of time. And then you're going to slowly increase the temperature. And the key with this is like there's no magical points in the literature. Like, yes, if you look at the sauna research, 185 degrees for multiple times per week for maybe 10 to 20 minutes per time. Like, yeah, there is some data on that. But that's just because we had to put some sort of boundaries on the studies. And we had to take that stimulus and try to quantify it across a whole group of people. My guess is that if you're just paying attention to your own biofeedback, like you're going to find that edge. And I like people to get out before it gets really difficult, because these things are physical stressors. Like I've seen people way overdo it on sauna, way overdo it on cold, white knuckle their way through all of it. Like safety aside, Like their heart rate variability, their stress numbers went like absolutely through the roof, very stressful, right? So we want stress, just like exercise, just like fasting, just like other things. But then we want the time to pull away and recover, get back to homeostasis, and then go again and repeat it.
So there's lots of ways to stress yourself, and you got to leave room and maybe even use techniques to unstress yourself so you can recover, so you can get better, so that you can do more.
Yeah, I have a saying that I say that pick your stressors before your stressors are picked for you. So like preemptively stress yourself so that you're more resilient. So like when the big poo hits the fan, like you're in a better spot.
This paper that I was talking about that I'll put in the show notes for everybody, they talk about stress as one of the things that we become worse at.
Yes.
As we get older.
As a population, yes. And I think it's because we literally don't pick those stressors to get better at, would be my argument.
Interesting. Okay, so another thing that was in that paper that I feel like it's important to say, the paper said the whole idea of hormesis, which is, you know, a little bit of damage and then you recover from the damage. I think they were trying to say, I don't know. What is true, though, is that this adaptive homeostasis, it doesn't require damage.
Nope.
Your body just will respond to the stress. And so in all of these things, I'm sure that what you're saying is, don't injure yourself. You don't need damage.
No.
Just the stress.
Yeah. And on one hand, it's cool that people are talking a lot more about hormetic stressors, and I think there's definitely value to that. A lot of that early literature on hormetic stressors, though, was from toxicology-based, and it was kind of assuming that you have to have damage, and then that triggers an adaptive response. And they did have early data to show that's true. Newer data would say adaptive homeostasis is probably a better term, because just like muscle damage, like you could still see a lot of really good progress for weightlifting, both in strength and hypertrophy, without damaging the muscle. Now, if you do damage the muscle, we do have repair mechanisms. We do know that that is beneficial. There may be a time and a place to do kind of what I call selective damage. But the fact that it's a requirement for progress is not true at all.
Great, great, great. Okay, so don't freeze yourself.
No.
Don't stay in the sauna until you pass out. I mean, don't do those things.
No, and you don't need to. Like someone asked me, they're like, well, if you do cold water and all this stuff, like why don't you ever really post your times or how long you're in on Instagram or whatever? I'm like, because I don't want to contribute to the pissing match that it's become, right? I mean, could I white knuckle my way through a lot of it? Sure. Is that going to be beneficial to add that much distress to my system? Probably not, unless I'm Wim Hof trying to break a, you know, world record. Like there's no like ice bath, you know, competitive competition or whatever.
Swimming under icebergs.
Yeah. Like you want enough to get the adaptation, and then you actually want the, you know, minimal effective dose. Like you want the ability to do it again, which is why I'm a fan of frequency.
Yeah.
So, you know, do it, get out, and then your body will adapt. Like the last part too is that there's some very, very interesting mice studies where they had hind limb tail suspension. The mice walked around in their front limbs all the time during the day. Mm-hmm. They did horrible things. They castrated them. They put them on low protein diets. They did all this stuff. What they found was they could not drive strength and muscle hypertrophy changes in the front limbs to zero. Now they could definitely reduce it, but they could not completely stop that adaptation process. So I think if you give the body the right stimulus, I don't think you can entirely stop the adaptation process. Now you can do things to hinder it, you can do things to delay it, but I think that process is just the innate part of being a human, and it's underappreciated.
Okay, great. So we're going to run out of time if we don't hurry up here, and it's all my fault. I'm sorry.
Oh, good.
So we talked about hot and cold. What's next?
So simply pH, you know, high pH, low pH. One is going to be more acidic, one is going to be more basic. So the acidic one we talked about was some high intensity intervals, high intensity work of any kind. The basic side's a little bit harder. The best way to do that is probably like the Wim Hof breathing or a super ventilation method or Tummo breathing, where probably lay down to start. Don't do this standing. Don't do this walking. For God's sake, don't ever do it in water. And then you're just going to inhale and exhale at a very, very fast rate. What you are doing is you're actually off-gassing a fair amount of CO2, and that will temporarily change your pH. There are other things long-term related to diet and some other stuff that may help, but that's probably the best one in terms of a controllable acute stimulus.
Okay.
Number three would be expanded fuels. So metabolic flexibility, we've got fat and carbohydrates. So the cousin of high carbohydrate use is going to be lactate. The cousin of high fat use is going to be ketones. So I do think you should spend some time running those systems also. So if you're kind of doing the high intensity interval stuff, if you expand that out a little bit more into slightly longer intervals over time, your body will produce more lactate and hydrogen ions. You can get fancy with weight training and use like blood flow restriction and other techniques like that. We do show now that lactate, George Brooks's lab has shown this just recently. I think this paper was published a couple months ago, that the generation of lactate as a air quote byproduct interacts directly on the epigenetic genome through a completely not even discovered pathway before. In English, that means that lactate is directly changing your genetic output as we speak by having the high levels of lactate around. In a good way.
Awesome.
Yeah, so those acute spikes of lactate do a lot of benefit things. The long, very low levels of lactate and hydrogen ions, not so good. But high-intensity exercise, very beneficial for that. Ketones, same thing. You know, can do longer periods of fasting with some moderate exercise. They do have beverages now, like I consult for Tecton. Mm. They have ketone esters. You can put yourself in a state of ketosis within about 20 minutes, pretty reliably. Now, I would argue that's probably good for cognition and some other things. You could also do exercise, you know, moderate level exercise under high levels of ketones also.
Great.
So you don't necessarily have to do a ketogenic diet. That would be one way, but practicality-wise, it's kind of hard to do.
Is it possible to do a ketogenic diet and also do the high intensity, you know, where you're burning glucose and making lactate?
Yes, but you will lose about 5 to 8, maybe 10% off your top end speed and power. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with an enzyme called PDH, pyruvate dehydrogenase, allowing basically carbohydrates to go into glycolysis to run that whole high energy system. Over time, with a ketogenic diet, the PDH enzyme changes. And so even if you gave those people a piss ton of carbohydrates before their exercise, they've lost some of that kind of that metabolic machinery to exercise it to the highest degree. Hmm. They'll still be able to do it. They'll still be able to do some of it. It's good. But your RPE goes up really high. I mean, I've done that before, and it feels, if you can imagine it feeling worse than what it would do normally, it feels worse than what it would do normally.
Yeah. I did a ketogenic diet one time, and when I would do anything that was higher intensity, my muscles felt dead.
Oh, yeah. And I've talked to high-end athletes who've tried this for years, and every single one of them to a T, they're like, I just feel like I'm missing that top gear.
Yeah.
Like I go to like competitive cyclists, I go to pass someone and drop the hammer on them. Like I just don't have the output. And these are high level athletes who it's not for a lack of effort.
Yeah. On the other hand, I never got hungry and I had endless energy. And I mean, it was a weird mixed bag.
Oh yeah. There's definitely some huge pros to it too. Right. Again, it's a trade-off. Like what are the pros and cons to everything? Like I work with some clients, we have them do a ketogenic diet because they love it. Cool. Great.
Yeah. Well, it's true. People are different and it depends on what you want. Right. I mean, if you're not doing high intensity stuff in your sport, then, you know, maybe you're a 100-mile runner.
Yeah.
Maybe it's perfect for you. Okay. Was there more?
Yeah. The last one is just oxygen and CO2 regulation.
Yeah.
And real simply, all you're doing with that is just regulating breath. So if you want to slowly accumulate and get better CO2 tolerance, you're going to do some type of light exercise with only nasal breathing. Mm. You're purposely going to restrict some of your breathing. The way you would know if you desperately need to do that is check your respiratory rate overnight. If you've got a watch, an Apple Ring, an Aura Ring, your respiratory rate is creeping 15, 16, 17, 18 breaths per minute, I can guarantee you definitely need to do some of that work because your CO2 tolerance is skewed. Mm. And then on the other side, like you can get into breath holds and things like that. They all have like their pros and their cons. And that was by far the hardest section to do. I think I redid those videos like 4 times or something like that, trying to take, literally I don't want to take three courses on that. We took a whole course on just how the lungs work, for crying out loud. You know, so like trying to distill all that into the one thing was a little hard.
I gotcha. And I guess that we're talking about getting good at stress. You know, one of the things that helps with stress is to not blow off too much of your CO2.
Yes.
So yeah, breathing, human beings have known breathing can affect your mental and emotional state for a long time.
Yeah, and there's a lot of merits to it. And the caveat I would leave people with is just learn a little bit about what breathing technique you're going to do for what intervention you're trying to get. Because not everything will help you. Like some things, like if your respiratory rate is super high at night and you're convinced you need to do Wim Hof Tumo super ventilation method, I guarantee it's going to make you way worse. So not all the breathing techniques are going to be beneficial for you as an individual, but all of them can be super beneficial overall if you pick the right one for the right thing you're trying to do.
All right. So people should have goals. They should prioritize according to their goals. But in general, people should try to push the range bigger over time. And that will, and they can get better over time, a bigger range. And the idea, at least my idea, is that that's turning you into a younger version of yourself, a healthier version of yourself.
Yes, I would agree. And especially over things we have the most direct control, I would argue all these things are under our control to an extremely high degree. You know, a lot of the mechanisms, a lot of the other things that are kind of, you know, touted as the next whiz bang test or this or that thing, like your genetics are kind of your genetics. Like you control like your epigenetics and how cards are played, but like these things, we have a very high amount of control over ourselves. And so I think we should use that to the highest degree we can first, and then, you know, probably not worry about as much of the other stuff.
All right. Fantastic, Dr. Mike. Hey, thanks again for coming back on the show. This has been great as always. Tell our audience how they can find you and more information about what you teach people.
Yeah. So I have a website, miketnelson.com. I have a few stuff that goes out over Instagram, which is Dr. Mike T. Nelson. The best way is probably the newsletter, which we send out, you know, usually daily. I go to miketnelson.com. There'll be a little link on the top that says newsletter. And yeah, just drop me a note there. Tell me you heard about it here. We'll have links and info there to the Flex Diet Cert, which opens again in January. It's just flexdiet.com. The Fizz Flex Cert will open again in March. But yeah, newsletters, probably the best way. Again, try to make them, you know, accurate, and try to make them as entertaining as I can too, which makes it kind of fun.
Fantastic. I'm on that list. I read them all the time.
Thank you.
And I also tell people that they should sign up for your podcast.
Yes, that was at the Flex Diet podcast too.
Exactly. It's all really good stuff. All right, Dr. Mike. Hey, man, that was really great. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much for joining my talk with Dr. Mike T. Nelson. This was another good one with Dr. Mike. You can find more information about Dr. Mike in the show notes.